Welcome to Changing the Narrative with Dena Eccles. As we face the five-year memorial of the police murder of George Floyd in May, it's significantly important to reflect on activist work and particularly on the backstepping we are experiencing with the undermining of diversity, equity, inclusion, and other initiatives to aid Black and marginalized communities. My guest for this podcast is Sandy Hudson, a multidisciplinary creative, writer, and activist, and founder of the Black Lives Matter Canada. She also co-founded the Black Legal Action Center in Ontario, Canada. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post, Toronto Star, and Huffington Post, and others. She holds a JD from the UCLA School of Law and a Master of Arts in Social Justice Education from the University of Toronto. She hosts the podcast Sandy and Nora Talk Politics and is co-author of the best-selling anthology Until We Are Free, Reflections on Black Lives Matter in Canada. Based in Los Angeles, she is co-executive producer of an 8-part CBC documentary series, Black Life, Untold Stories, which was an official selection of the 2023 Toronto International Film Festival. So in all of that, she still has time to come and talk to us.
Yeah.
And today we'll be speaking about her new book, Defund Black Lives, Policing, and Safety for All. So welcome, Sandy. I'm very happy to have you today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dena.
So I have to tell you, I was really engrossed in your book. I think it's bold, it's accurate, and deeply needed.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So let's just start with, you know, you're asking people to suspend notions of policing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just dive right into that.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that really stunts the conversation about public safety, and you know, I want to push us to be talking really about public safety, not just policing. We want to talk about safety in our communities. Mm. One of the things that really stunts that conversation are these mythological, mirage-like ideas that we have about what provides safety to us, and that being the police. We've essentially married the idea of safety and policing. Mm. And that could not be further from the truth when it comes to what actually creates safe conditions, safe communities. And I mean, the proof is really in, I'll ask your listeners to engage in a thought experiment with me. Like, what are the safest communities or the safest places they've ever been? What do they look like? What do they feel like? And are they teeming with cops? And if they're not, then I think we have an issue if we are marrying in our minds the idea of safety and policing. And so I really want people, when they engage with this book, to put aside all the preconceived notions that they might have about policing, about safety, and to just really engage with the material, because it's quite logical when you consider it.
Right. I loved the way you covered the history of policing. And I think that that's a piece that's missing for a lot of us. If you would like to go into that a little bit, you know, particularly how it began back in Ireland.
yeah. I think that this is, like, really crucial, because one of the things that I think people struggle with is there's this idea that policing was created to keep us safe. And, again, that also couldn't be further from the truth. That's not what it was created for. And, in fact, the reasons it was created, it seems to be accomplishing those goals. It continues to accomplish those goals fairly well in our contemporary world. And so there are really kind of four bases for why policing was created. One of them, policing in its modern form, one of them being to control colonized populations. And so we see the beginning of policing in the English-speaking world, and arguably the first modern paid uniformed police force being implemented in Ireland as Britain's first colony, to control the Irish population, to make sure that there was that subjugated population would be controlled, would be corralled into the spaces they were allowed to be corralled in, and did not have self-determination and power over their lives so that the British could rule over them and could benefit from the land and the military benefits of having control over Ireland. And you know, they couldn't use the military that they had because they were having some issues with the American Revolution.
I was going to say 1786, yeah.
Exactly. And so they wanted to create a military-like force that could control that population. So that's what it was for. It was not for safety.
So, yeah.
And the success of that, you know, they have all of these other colonies in the Caribbean, in the southern United States. They say, wow, like this worked really well. Maybe we can implement something like that over here. So again, more colonization in Canada and other colonies around the world, making sure that indigenous populations are removed from places that they don't want them to be and are strictly controlled. And then again, you know, again, very successful there. They also need to control enslaved populations as the economy becomes more reliant on slave labor. They need to control populations of people that are starting to outnumber their masters. And so they create these forces to recapture people who free themselves, to make sure that there is punishment that will deter enslaved people from taking actions to try to regain their power and to regain their freedom. And so we get these slave-catching forces starting to pop up, especially in the southern United States and in the Caribbean. And then the third really big piece of why policing was created was that at this time, the economy was starting to move towards a wage-based economy, which was kind of strange for workers at that time. Workers were used to getting paid in part by being able to take a little bit of what they had produced for the ownership class. So, you know, if you were a part of bringing coffee over on a ship, you would take some of the coffee for yourself because, you know, you worked it. It made sense that you would take some of it. And they implemented these laws as these owners were trying to extract as much wealth from what they were producing as possible. And they were trying to move over to a wage form of payment in order to control workers better. They implemented laws that these workers were not allowed to take portions of what they had helped to produce. And they needed to control those workers who were like, this is very strange. And who were starting to try to organize unions and syndicates to try to support one another. And so policing was also created, especially in the northern United States, the more urban centers in like London, to really crack down on workers. And then finally, the other big thing is that policing was created for sort of like a moral social control to make sure that people weren't drinking during times of prohibition or engaging in gambling in public spaces, that kind of thing. And that certainly continues today.
Yes, it does. Yeah, the organization, the police stopping organizing, that one reminded me. I grew up in the Pittsburgh area.
So, oh, yeah.
But, you know, I never learned, 45 minutes from Pittsburgh, I never learned about the Homestead riots and the Pinkertons, the armed militia that shot people, you know, during that strike. And that was all around the same time. And, you know, so it really drove it home to me that this was a real thing, that you were highlighting the night watch, the maritime police, all of the things that you talk about in your book. These are really important things for people to know their history, because like I said, I grew up never learning it and went to college, and that somehow then I found out about it. You know, it's important that we understand the history of policing. So I was really grateful that you put that in your book.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it's really relevant for today, where we have actually, quite frankly, what's happening in a lot of the world right now is these class-based struggles. You know, people are really, really struggling as the wealthiest among us continue to take more and more and more of a share of all the things that people around the world are producing. And so it is important for us to understand, like, how did those owners become so protected? Like, how is it such a normal thing for us to think, well, they get this and we get nothing, or we get scraps? And it was really, really implemented through the power of policing. So many workers died, and we really don't know that history. So many workers died from the mid-1800s to right up until the Great Depression. There were so many strikes that were very bloody, very, very bloody. And, you know, we can sort of see a continuation of that today in some of the crackdowns that people are experiencing when they try to organize around various issues, that whether they're issues of race or climate, they're all kind of related to class as well, because who is most harmed when during the climate crisis? Who is most harmed with issues of anti-blackness, racial discrimination? It's people who are the most impoverished, who are the most urgently harmed. And we see police really trying to control our voices on that.
Right, yes. And that brings me to the part that you talked about, where around 1910, the police started to fight back because people were not happy with the police. They started to get a grip on what was happening. And then there was the Hays Code of Morals for TV.
That is right. You know, that, well, I remember when I learned this, I was like really quite like, wow. It was really a concerted and deliberate effort.
Absolutely.
Very deliberate effort to shift how people thought about policing. Because, you know, in the early 1900s, generally the population was not thinking, wow, a force to serve and protect. That was not how people thought about it. And, you know, you might remember, I definitely remember Saturday morning cartoons with the like idea of the like bumbling police officer. And that doesn't really exist anymore. And but that idea of that bumbling police officer who wasn't really doing much was like, that comes out of this entertainment tradition where that reflected what the public thought about policing at the time. And so, you know, there was an international organization of policing. It was like, you know, they were like, we got to get a hold of this. We have to stop the public from having these opinions of us. And so they convinced governments to change rules around what could be shown in entertainment, to try to control what was being fed back to populations about what they felt about policing. And, you know, that's how it started, to try to prevent certain narratives from being put on television, like the widespread corruption that has always existed in policing. Things like the Hays Code prevented those types of narratives from proliferating in entertainment, to police forces collaborating with government and entertainment production companies to create literal propaganda, like Dragnet, like, you know, what we see today in Law and Order. You know, there was it was a concerted effort to make sure this is how we want policing to appear on television, up until like police being able to approve the storylines that were put on television.
Right, and that's what was happening with Dragnet. I was, again, when I got to that part of your book, it kind of came at me glaringly, because Dragnet started the year of my birth, 1955, you know, and I realized how indoctrinated we were at that time, you know, because it was, oh yeah, Dragnet's on, everybody's going to watch it. You know, wasn't watching it when I was one and two, but it was still on. It lasted for a long time.
Oh, it certainly did. Yeah. And it's completely impacted entertainment television. I mean, most, one of the largest categories of things that you could watch on television at any given time is the police procedural. And, you know, that all starts in part with early depictions like Dragnet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did notice also in your book, you mentioned a couple projects that I am fond of. One was Color of Change, Normalizing Injustice, and the Innocence Project. I just thought you could mention something about their work or the importance of, particularly the Innocence Project, because so many people are just, to satisfy this lust for punishment, so many people are arrested that aren't even guilty.
Yeah, I think that, until people have a interaction with the criminal legal system, they don't really understand just how unjust it is. Mm. It is a real quagmire, and it requires significant reimagining, reshaping. Mm. It's unbelievable how poorly the system operates. This idea that one is innocent until proven guilty is a wonderful notion that frankly doesn't exist.
Right.
And for so many people, especially if you don't have the resources to afford the best representation for yourself, especially if you don't have the resources to take time away from your family to defend yourself. Mm-hmm. If you are, God forbid, swept up in this criminal system, so often people are taking plea deals. They're taking plea deals that say that they're guilty even when they're not, mm-hmm. so that they can resolve a case quicker, take down the risk of having to be in this system for years and years and years, trying to defend yourself, losing potential ability to take care of yourself throughout that time. And I don't think people realize that, like, it is, I don't have the statistic right in front of me, but I believe it's somewhere over like 85% of people are likely to take plea deals. Mm. And it's really, I mean, that to me is just so unconscionable. People really think, you know, when somebody has a conviction, that it means that it is proof of some sort of criminality, but it's not. And the other thing is that even if it's for something minor, it can affect your life significantly for the rest of your life and your ability to get certain jobs, to access certain services, and so on. You become a different class of citizen that for which it is very, very difficult to engage in any sort of social mobility, and the power of yourself to like determine your own future is significantly restricted.
Right. Yeah, and you bring that up, I think it's chapter 6 in your book, when you ask the question, what is considered a crime? Because in so many, it's become that homelessness now is criminal.
And, like, what an awful thing, you know, at a time when many people can't afford rent, you know, housing, ownership, home ownership is out of the realm of possibility for so many people. And it can take, you know, most people are living paycheck to paycheck, and it can be one awful circumstance, an illness, an injury, that can change someone's ability to afford rent and be living in their car or out on the street. And how do we deal with that situation in so many urban spaces and beyond? We police people. We get the police to, and I'm using we, but I'm talking about the public here, like public services, police to corral these people, arrest them, remove them, steal the stuff that the very few things that possessions that they may have, making it even more difficult to come out of that situation. And we're spending so many resources on this, so many resources when we could be spending resources on making sure that people have a place to live. Right. It is a basic necessity of life that we need shelter. And why wouldn't we spend more money providing for that rather than criminalizing people, saying, you can't sleep in this public space? Well, I don't have access to a private space.
Right.
So what can I do? Where can I be? You want me to disappear? You know, and we use policing to then make those people essentially disappear, a form of banishment through arresting them. And I, you know, that just doesn't seem like what we want in living in a free and democratic society.
Right, and which is now what we're seeing in on steroids.
Absolutely.
Right, so it's a crime to be in public spaces. It's a crime to panhandle most places. And it's even become crimes to build tiny houses. Not so much, but they make it difficult. You know, they
yes.
say, well, it's not a crime, but you have to jump through 60,000 rules and to help someone. It's crazy. It's absurd, really. I'm so glad that you
really
put that.
Yeah, it's really easy to punish someone. Mm. It's really easy to harm them, but it's so hard to help them, especially if no one's going to make tons of money off of it.
Right. And then I think in the same chapter you point out that all policing is morality policing.
Yes.
I think that's another very, very important important comment that people need to take in, because if, you know, you're white and heterosexual and whatever, if you kind of pass in that way, you're ignored. You could be doing all the same things, but it's somehow okay. But those cultural stereotypes, you know, people are queer. People are, you know, many things.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest tells of that is what we see happening with cannabis right now.
Mm.
You know, like, you can decide to engage with things that like mind-altering substances, or they're talking about alcohol or cannabis or any other sort of drug as a crime. You can decide the use of this is a crime, or you can decide the use of this should be regulated, or you can decide it doesn't have to be regulated, whatever, right? Like, these are decisions that are made at a political level. You know, there was a time when prohibition was the norm across the land, that alcohol was considered a crime, and the use of alcohol was considered a crime. And now we don't think about it that way. Now we think of alcohol as something that is recreational use. We're seeing that transition with cannabis. Now, when cannabis was thought to be mostly used by populations that were not dominant, like black populations that were not dominant, that were considered wayward and criminal and subjugated class, it was criminal. And then as it started to become more popular with the dominant population, with white folks, we're seeing the proliferation of decriminalization attempts throughout the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, to regulate it, to make it normal, to get it in stores and so on. And no matter what you think about cannabis use or alcohol use or any other drug for that matter, what deciding it is a crime does is it implements a kind of moral on it. In our society, it is morally incorrect.
Right.
To smoke marijuana. And as a result, all of these people deserve to go to jail. And now, in our society, now that it is more popular among youths with the more dominant and powerful in society, okay, well, now it's not morally incorrect. It doesn't matter that there's still a whole bunch of people in prison for this, okay? But it's no longer morally incorrect. And not only that, it's going to be a massive industry through which people can make millions, millions of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. And you see the way that policing is there to really enforce a kind of moral on people that really has us thinking about different populations differently.
Right. That was, again, you did a very good job, I thought, helping people understand that. And it's so important to get people to rethink Because we could push this. We can push this defunding of police. We can push the, you know, turn towards a better world, a different world that isn't based on causing harm. But I just want to let our listeners know that this is Changing the Narrative. I'm Dina Eccles, and my guest is Sandy Hudson on her new book, Defund Black Lives, Policing and Safety for All. And we're just covering a whole lot of good stuff, important things. The one other thing that you touch on is the betrayal of trust. You know, it's like looking at the fact that we kind of just touched on it with people now capitalizing on marijuana and the sales of marijuana. But when you have these large corporations doing these incredibly horrible things, and they basically get a slap on the wrist. But again, people who are considered less than, black and indigenous women, gender-based people, those people are mistreated in a higher way. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Oh, yeah. Like, this is one of those things that once you see it, you can't really unsee it,
yep.
You know?
Thankfully.
It's like of how unjust the system is. It is, you know, you will have a kid who maybe engages in the sale of drugs, or maybe buying drugs, languishing away in prison for so long, having not harmed anyone. Maybe themselves, who knows, but having not harmed anyone, languishing away in prison as punishment for that engagement. It has nothing to do with safety and security, mind you. Let's remember that, right? And yet, there are whole industries of people who have harmed people. Like, let's talk about Purdue Pharma, for example, with the opioid crisis that it has pushed onto people all over the world. We can talk about Monsanto and the terrible health effects of some of their products that have caused cancer, that have killed people, countless people. And like, who's had roles for that? Like, these are people who have been harmed, and these companies, rather than being subject to policing like people are, they are subject to regulation, and they're often able to pay some sort of fine, not a fine that's going to end their company, no, because corporations and businesses are really quite important and are inherently meaningful or inherently valuable in our society. And so they get to pay some sort of fine and continue on the way that they are operating, or they pay some sort of settlement and they continue operating the way that they are operating. But when it comes to individual people, even if we don't harm someone, if we're just in prison because we cannot afford a place to live, or because we had a mental health crisis one day and a police officer didn't like the way that we were expressing ourselves, and so we got arrested, that could end the rest of our lives.
Right.
Whereas these corporations that can be, quite frankly, murderous, are able to continue to harm and kill people with very, very little consequence.
Right. Again, it's so important that these things be spoken about. It's so important that people hear it, because it's just, we accept it. You know, we're still operating out of dragnet.
You know, yes,
and
exactly.
Just blinded. But you talk about controlling spaces, racial profiling, you know, just that kind of thing that goes on in particularly marginalized black communities, marginalized communities. I can remember being at a gay bar way back in the 70s and the police showing up to be paid so that, you know, they wouldn't bust the place. I mean, I heard you and I read these things, because you just lived through it, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's what's happening. But why are we tolerating it? You know, why do we tolerate it? You use a lot of really painful stories that are true stories, you know, like Eric Garner selling cigarettes.
Yeah.
You know? And I appreciate it. It was hard reading because I know those stories. A lot of people don't, they don't follow it. They don't, you know, it, I don't know if it doesn't impact them directly. Maybe it's not as important, or somehow we you know, back the blue. So, you know, somehow we're sure that the police did the right thing. But it's really time. Your book is very timely.
Thank you. And it, I mean, it's such a strange instinct, huh, that we think that, you know, the police are doing the right thing all the time. And a lot of that has to do with the propaganda that we're watching on television. In the book, I refer to it as copaganda, which is a word that a lot of activists have started to use because it's just so ubiquitous. And the thing is, you know, we don't have that sort of deference for when we're hearing about, for example, cuts to education and to teachers or any other sort of public service that we might benefit from in society. But for some reason, for policing, which, you know, never seems to be able to solve the safety issue year after year that we have in our communities, never seems to be able to make it better.
Mm.
For some reason, we're always just like, oh, no, they were doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people really, you know, when they see the data and the stories together in this book, I'm hoping that they're disabused of these ideas of, mm-hmm. you know, how helpful policing really is. I, you know, one of these, the stories that I tell that is, you know, not as affecting as some of the really horrendous stories in the book, but I think is really, really important, is a story of a conversation that I had while I was in Portland in 2020 with a woman who owned a hotel that I was staying at. And, you know, she was like, you know, I'm really proud to support Black Lives Matter. And, but, you know, there's just one thing, you know, that I'm just not quite sure about. I just don't know about this defunding of the police. That feels really, really bad. Like, what are we going to do when we need the police? And I was like, okay, well, what situation are you thinking of? She's like, well, if someone comes to my house and, you know, steal thing and it's in my house, I need to be able to call the police. And I, you know, like, that is such a response that people have. Like, I need to be able to call somebody, you know, to come and help me, to save me, which is, you know, great that we want to have that. It's great that we could potentially have that. But is that what we have? Is it? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I had to press her. I was like, okay, so what happens? You come home, you realize that your place has been messed with. And it's already happened. So that person who's stolen from you is no longer there, which is the case most of the time. And then you call the police. Okay, they show up. They haven't, you know, they've already failed because they haven't prevented that from happening. You know, we want to live in a society where we're preventing that from happening, where we're like thinking about what are the things that cause people to take these really risky behaviors to take from somebody else. What are the things that drive somebody there? Like, that's kind of what I'm hoping that we're moving to. But, okay, we're in the place where someone has stolen from you. You call the police. They arrive. Now what? And she's like, well, you know, they would do an investigation. They would look through, gather evidence, and then they would find the guy, and I would get my stuff back. And I was like, you know, that's the fantasy that we're provided through these narratives we see on television. And it's just not true. Less than 15% of these kinds of cases are ever result in a charge being laid, and a charge being laid means nothing. A charge being laid does not mean they found the correct person. It means they laid a charge, and very often police officers or police institutions will lay charges even though they know they haven't fully solved the case, because they need their numbers to go up because the numbers look so bad. And so, you know, the police very likely, and many people who listening to this show may have experienced this, are very unlikely to solve the issue. They're very likely to tell you there's nothing we can really do here. And then what happens? you call your insurance company and you try to recover what you can. And it's like, can't we just move to that part? Like, not do the mirage and instead spend the resources that we're spending on this mirage of like a personal crime fighting hero to show up and help you out. Like, let's spend the resources on trying to prevent the issue from happening in the first place.
Right, right. Now, it's, yeah. And you point out that some of the training that the police go through, like, they have a warrior training.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and we've seen it. We've seen this play out over and over and over again where everyone is a threat. Everyone, you know, they got a toy in their hand and they're a threat.
You know?
And then, you know, there was a young Native man, young boy, really, who was having a mental health issue, and the police came in, and on the street, he was killed. And the storyline afterward was that he was suiciding. They blamed the kid.
I know.
I was just like, I was horrified.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how do we get, how twisted do we have to become? How far from our humanity do we have to become to continue to accept these storylines?
Yeah.
You know? So
it's really quite terrible. Mm. Another personal story that I told in the book that's along these lines is a story, it was an experience that I had in Toronto, coming out of a memorial for someone who had been killed by police. And it was a Black Lives Matter event, so there were police all over it because they used to follow us around the city. But, you know, it was a memorial. It was quite a somber event. And we cleaned up at the end of the night, and we're leaving. You know, it's nighttime, sun is down, and there's still police all around the building where we were having this. And it's, you know, we were in a place where there was a pedestrianized street, so there's no cars or anything like that. It was a place where people are walking around. And a black man comes running down the street, screaming, crying, just like wailing. And all of the police, we saw them, like, jump into action, you know, getting their batons out, starting to run after this man. And me and my colleagues were really concerned, so we started to run as well. And a couple of my friends, you know, this black man, he collapsed onto the ground, and he's still screaming. A couple of my friends, you know, kind of collapsed on top of him to try to protect him from the police who were crowding around. And me and a few others were trying to put ourselves in between the police and this man. And we were like, what are you doing? You know, they have their batons out. We're like, what's going on? They're like, they started accusing us of obstructing justice, that they needed to arrest him. And we were like, arrest him for what? You know, he's just running down the street and screaming. And this woman comes running down the street afterwards, behind him, and she's like, what is happening? Why are there all of these police around? And she starts to explain, you know, his mother just died in his arms, and he was inconsolable, could not process, you know, his reaction to that was running out into the public street, pedestrianized, not even, you know, like, in the way of cars or something like that, and screaming and crying. And the police were going to arrest him. You know, he calmed down after, you know, my friends were hugging him. His friend arrived and was like, it's okay, it's okay. The police are standing around, you know, again, with their batons out, tasers in some of their hands, like looking like, and eventually they just kind of slink away. Mm. You know, like, why do we have this force that is programmed to think of people who are maybe slightly out of the norm as a combatant,
right?
As someone that they need to engage as a problem. This man was not a problem.
No.
He was crying. It was really quite awful.
Yeah, I mean, so what you're hoping to see, this change you're hoping to see, not only will help the people that are being ill affected, but it will also help the police. They shouldn't be taken through warrior trainings. You know, this is insanity. I mean, and I love that in the book you start to really talk about compassion clubs and changes that are happening in different cities where they're trying to bring in non-policed groups, you know, of people to help in these situations. I think that that's so important that we also talk about what can be going on.
Yeah, I think, you know, so often some of the real solutions that we need when politicians and the public are failing to provide those solutions, so often the solutions come from community members making them happen themselves. Right. And there are groups that have started to do things like provide emergency services for mental health crises. And some of these have been so successful that they're being taken up at like at a city level or even at a state level in some circumstances. We see some major successes happening in Oregon, in Arizona, in Toronto. Community interrupters who are trying to interrupt violence and the causes of violence in communities. We see that happening in Chicago mm-hmm. and places all over the world. And then these compassion clubs that you've mentioned, which are really interesting approaches to, instead of criminalizing drug users who, you know, if you have an addiction, that's like a physical reaction. That is uncontrollable. And so to criminalize something like that is like, it's like, are we trying to solve a problem, or are we just trying to erase people? You know, like that's kind of how we're thinking about it on a societal level. Well, these compassion clubs, they try to do what they can to provide access to drugs that are safe. And by safe, I mean they're not like laced with substances that are more likely to harm or kill people, mm-hmm. and that people can engage in these substances in a place where they might have access to a nurse or some life-saving attention if they need mm-hmm. it. And so, in order to say, okay, these people, we don't want you to be criminalized or end up in prison, because that's not going to help you either. Here's what we can do to try to make sure that, you know, you're alive. And in this condition, how can we provide additional support or help to you should you need and want it?
It's the human thing to do.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's time. We've been mostly, I think, because of capital ownership, we have been under the weight of this understanding of policing. You call it the curse of policing at one point mm-hmm. in your book. And I think it's, you know, to start to recognize human beings as human beings. That is a core thing that has to happen in order for it to change. And I'm going to...
Yeah.
I'm going to quote you again here. You know, you say, we are worth it. It may be arduous, but it is possible.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's so crucial. Like, we are just, you know, as humans, I think we are inherently valuable. Like, we mm-hmm. are worth it. And I mean, we hear narratives and we see stories all the time of people who are wealthy who, like, make a mistake, who like have an addiction, but then they have access to lots of money, so they can just go to rehab that they can pay for,
right? Or get
like,
a good lawyer
arrested for it, or get a really great lawyer to solve the issue, right? And yet, you know,
I think we have a president in that. I'm sorry. No, sorry.
No, but you're right. You're totally right. Mm-hmm. And whereas, you know, we've got people who like literally have to decide between paying the fare on the subway and mm-hmm. like affording milk for their family in the next week. And it's just like, those people, are they not worthy too? Mm-hmm. Like, can we not have some resources to make sure that we all have the basic necessities of life. Like, if we in a society want to force people to work in order to live, can't we just make sure that they have the ability to get to work?
Right.
You know, like, it's just these simple questions, like reframing the issue of, like, you know, does a person who tries to skip out on the fare deserve to be in jail or deserve to have a conviction on their record? Or can we, like, think about not spending all this money on policing people who are trying to get to work or wherever they need to be, and instead spend that money on making it more affordable or free? It's like, we are worth it. Mm-hmm. We are worth it. We are worth that sort of consideration. And that's what this is all about. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, Dina, I really think the things that create safety in our lives are when we have access to the basic necessities of life, when everybody does, to the basic necessities of life. And we create risky situations when we force people to engage in risk in order to afford the necessities of life. And when I talk about necessities, I am talking about, you know, food, shelter, and all of that good stuff, transportation. But I'm also talking about leisure. Like, we're human beings. We need space and time in our lives to spend with our families and to enjoy ourselves. Like, all of those things that the wealthy have because they can afford it, we should have it too, even if we don't have the ability to pay for a little bit of time when we can have some time to have dinner with our families, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I think really does create safe societies. So I'd love us to spend a little less money on policing and punishment, a little more money making sure that we all can provide for each other
strong communities,
a life that is worthy and dignified.
Right, dignity. Yeah. I love that word, dignity. Strong communities. I think we're seeing that reemergence of community and people recognizing the need to support one another, mutual aid, I think is a really, it'll be a significant player in this next bit of time where things look rather dire. I had the good fortune of spending time on the Navajo Diné Reservation, reservation. I had a wonderful mentor there. And at one point I realized that she was considered a peacemaker of her tribe. And what that meant was that instead of going to lawyers and calling the police and doing different things that would probably bring harm and probably were not affordable, they would come to her and she would just sit with them. And I'm sure a lot of prayer was involved, and I'm sure a lot of things. I didn't participate in any of the exact things that she did. But just to have that understanding that peace is something that can be, that we need to support, that we need to honor. And I think the communities are going to bring it back. I think they're working on it. I always have kept a close eye on Detroit. I have good friends there, the Boggs Center up there, Grace Lee Boggs, and the folks, you know, there in Milwaukee, watching what's happening in Milwaukee. I live out in the middle of the rural parts of the state, and I think that isolation has done great harm to people here. They've been profoundly affected by Dragnet, and I think it will be good, you know, that people hear this conversation and can start to share it with other people, because it's just a question of consciousness, isn't it, really?
It is. And, you know, I too really love the Grace Lee Boggs Center. I'm glad that you mentioned that. And these sort of centers where people are trying to create a different sort of norm and reality than the ones that we're kind of forced into. I mean, I look around right now, and I could have written about this in the book, but I didn't. And, you know, maybe this is something that I should consider in another
book.
For my next book. But I look around right now at the type of policing that is happening of immigrant communities and migrant communities, right? And the sort of the way that we're talking about them, you know, like as abductions, because that's really what they are, like arrests or kind of like abductions of people from their community for no criminal activity whatsoever, but for who they are.
Right.
And that sort of reprehensible action that is happening right now, it really isolates people. It's meant to make us feel alone
and fearful.
So we can't connect.
And yes. Fearful. It's meant to,
and fearful.
To drive fear into the, that's and, why I was like, oh, I'm so glad we're doing this conversation today. I'm so glad we're talking, because it's a lightning rod. Defund the police, in case you didn't know this, is a lightning rod. But it's so important that we talk about it. It's so important that we point out that there are people that now the government is admitting were taken and shouldn't be, but are now telling us they have no way of bringing them back.
Exactly.
I mean, this
is... Exactly.
And then I just say to all these people who just... accept that answer. I say, where, how do you tolerate the cruelty? How do you do this? And I just wonder what it's going to take. You know, when it happens, right, is it going to be you? What's it going to be that's going to make you understand that this thing we've lived with for centuries is not worthy of us?
No. No. And I think, you know, the way that we combat that in our communities and in our lives is we have to refuse the instinct to isolate. It actually makes things easier for a fascist administration to attack people if they're isolated.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have to be more connected with one another in community, providing for one another what we need, supporting one another. And, you know, if we study history, you know, these moments have happened before. If we study history, the thing that's going to stop what's happening is a concerted effort from average people creating a movement of refusal and saying, absolutely not, we will not accept this. And we cannot do that if we are isolated from one another. We have to be connected to one another. We have to be creative in the way that we support one another when the government completely abandons us or is attacking us. And it's so important that we're thinking of these things right now and operationalizing them right now so that it doesn't go too far. You know, it's already gone too far.
Mm.
It's already gone far too far. You know, I say in the book, policing has been allowed, you know, something like 150 to 200 years to fail us over and over and over again. Isn't it time? Isn't it time for us to insist on something different? I think so.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. I'm so glad that I ran across the possibility of speaking with you today and got to read your book. It's a great book. I mean, you have told so many important stories that aren't stories, they're real live occurrences that shouldn't have happened to any of those people.
Yeah.
I mean, it just shouldn't be. The fact that we can tolerate, the fact that we tolerate over and over and over again all of these, I don't want to leave this to the next generation, you know?
No.
I don't want to leave it. I, as long as I'm... You know, you said we all need to do something, and this is what I do. You know, I invite people like you to be on the radio and you know, have a chance to really look at what we've allowed and know that, and find courage and clarity to turn it around.
And I so appreciate people like you because, you know, in this last period, like, especially since Trump has been elected and has taken office, I've heard so much on mainstream media that, you know, the Democrats, you know, they went too far, especially with that defund the police thing, that, you know, people just throw it out as though it's just so obvious that that was nonsense. But it's like, folks, think about what you're saying. Think about what you're saying. Like, I really want people to just engage with, you know, like the nonsense of the status quo.
It would be nice if the Democratic leadership got with the program. I mean, we just had the vote of once again, are we going to send money to Israel? And sure enough, only 15 people voted with Bernie Sanders, and you just and again, you
there's
know,
there's always money for harm and punishment and genocide. And,
you know,
but
how
you
come?
Know.
How come, good Christian nation? How come? This is what I ask my friends. How come? You know, so it's time. I think it's time. I think it's the time of people of peace, and they can be as it's like they're willing to make us feel afraid, and I feel like, man, it's not my turn to be afraid. It's my turn.
Yeah.
It's my turn to shine. It's
I'm
our
with
turn.
That.
Yeah, I know. I read your book. I read your book. And I'm like, you go. So anything that you'd like to leave us with as we come to the end of the hour here?
I really, really want people to, you know, if you think that the conversation feels like this is impossible, I want you to know it really is, because it is possible to shift things, to change things in our society. We've done it before. There are places around the world that are doing it, and we deserve better. Like, we know right now the way we are living, it's not it. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
We know that.
Mm-hmm.
We can all feel this sort of anxiety of living in this situation, in this society where things could be so much better in the richest nation on earth. Come on. And so I really want people to just open their minds and engage and just know that all things can change, you know. Trump is in fact proving that right now. You can change things if you want. You know, COVID proved it to us too.
Yeah,
you know, things were changed very, very quickly.
Yep.
And so just remember that it's possible. And really, really think, you know, we're all worth it.
Yeah. Thank you on that kind of little bit twisted note
that he's
actually bringing us all together. Well,
yeah.
I just want to say, Sandy, it's been a pleasure and an honor to host you today. And I hope
your
book reaches a lot of people, especially young people who may feel a little hopeless, but it's time to forge a new frontier of peace and justice that's not based in class, property, social indifference, but is instead based in humanity and the dignity of every human being.
Yes. Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me, Dina.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And I want to leave listeners with this quote from Arundhati Roy that's highlighted in Sandy's book. Another world is not only possible, she's on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. This has been Changing the Narrative with Dina Eccles. My guest has been Sandy Hudson on her new book, Defund Black Lives, Policing, and Safety for All. Thank you for listening. Thanks to WDRT Studios for having us. Please share this podcast with a friend. Let's turn this ship around.